You open the book and turn to the first page. Nora did so. Okay, said Mrs. Elm with careful precision. Now read the first line. Nora stared down and read. She walked out of the pub into the cool night air. And Nora had just enough time to think to herself, pub? After that, it was happening. The text began to swirl and soon became indecipherable in fast motion as she felt herself weaken. She never knowingly let go of the book, but there was a moment where she was no longer a person reading it, and a consequent moment where there was no book or library at all. The Three Horseshoes. Nora was standing outside in crisp, clean air. But unlike in Bedford, it wasn't raining here.
Where am I?
She whispered to herself. There was a small row of quaint stone terraced houses on the other side of the gently curving road. Quiet, old houses with all their lights off, nestled at the edge of a village before fading into the stillness of the countryside. A clear sky. An expanse of dotted stars. A waning crescent moon. The smell of fields. The two-way twit-to-woo of tawny owls. And then quiet again. A quiet that had a presence, that was a force in the air. Weird. She had been in Bedford, then in that strange library, and now she was here, on a pretty village road, without hardly even moving. On this side of the road, golden light filtered out of a downstairs window. She looked up and saw an elegantly painted pub sign creaking softly in the wind. Overlapping horseshoes underneath carefully italicized words. The Three Horseshoes. In front of her, there was a chalkboard standing on the pavement. She recognized her own handwriting at its neatest. The Three Horseshoes. Tuesday night. Quiz night. 8:30 p.m. True knowledge exists in knowing that you know nothing. Socrates. After losing our quiz. This was a life where she put 4 exclamation marks in a row. That was probably what happier, less uptight people did. A promising omen. She looked down at what she was wearing. A denim shirt with sleeves rolled halfway up her forearms, and jeans and wedge-heeled shoes, none of which she wore in her actual life. She had goosebumps from the cold and clearly wasn't dressed to be outside for long. There were 2 rings on her ring finger. Her old sapphire engagement ring was there, the same one she had taken off through trembles and tears over a year ago, accompanied by a simple silver wedding band. Crackers. She was wearing a watch, not a digital one in this life, an elegant, slender analog one with Roman numerals. It was about a minute after midnight. How is this happening? Her hands were smoother in this life. Maybe she used hand cream. Her nails shone with clear polish. There was some comfort in seeing the familiar small mole on her left hand. Footsteps crunched on gravel. Someone was heading towards her down the driveway. A man, visible from the light of the pub windows and the solitary street lamp. A man with rosy cheeks and grey Dickensian whiskers and a waxed jacket. A Toby jug made flesh. He seemed, from his overly careful gait, to be slightly drunk.
Good night, Nora. I'll be back on Friday. For the folk singer, Dan said he's a good one.
In this life, she probably knew the man's name.
Right, yes, of course, Friday. Should be a great night.
At least her voice sounded like her. She watched as the man crossed the road, looking left and right a few times despite the clear absence of traffic, and disappearing down a lane between the cottages. It was really happening. This was actually it. This was the pub life. This was the dream made reality. This is so very weird, she said into the night. So very weird. A group of 3 left the pub then too, 2 women and a man. They smiled at Nora as they walked past.
We'll win next time, one of the women said. Yes, replied Nora. There's always a next time.
She walked up to the pub and peeked through the window. It seemed empty inside, but the lights were still on. That group must have been the last to leave. The pub looked very inviting, warm and characterful. Small tables and timber beams and a wagon wheel attached to a wall. A rich red carpet and a wood-paneled bar full of an impressive array of beer pumps. She stepped away from the window and saw a sign just beyond the pub, past where the pavement became grass. Quickly she trotted over and read what it said. Littleworth welcomes careful drivers. Then she noticed in the top centre of the sign a little coat of arms around which orbited the words, Oxfordshire County Council.
We did it,
she whispered into the country air.
We actually did it.
This was the dream Dan had first mentioned to her while walking by the Seine in Paris, eating macarons they had bought on the Boulevard Saint-Michel. A dream not of Paris, but of rural England, where they would live together. A pub in the Oxfordshire countryside. When Nora's mum's cancer aggressively returned, reaching her lymph nodes and rapidly colonising her body, that dream was put on hold, and Dan moved with her from London back to Bedford. Her mum had known of their engagement and had planned to stay alive long enough for the wedding. She had died 4 months too soon. Maybe this was it. Maybe this was the life. Maybe this was first time lucky or second time lucky. She allowed herself an apprehensive smile. She walked back along the path and crunched over the gravel, heading towards the side door the drunken, whiskery man in the wax jacket had recently departed from. She took a deep breath and stepped inside. It was warm and quiet. She was in some kind of hallway or corridor. Terracotta floor tiles, low wood panelling and, above, wallpaper full of illustrations of sycamore leaves. She walked down the little corridor and into the main pub area, which she had peeked at through the window. She jumped as a cat appeared out of nowhere. An elegant, angular chocolate Burmese purring away. She bent down and stroked it, and looked at the engraved name on the disc attached to the collar. Voltaire. A different cat with the same name. Unlike her dear, beloved Ginger Tabby, she doubted this Voltaire was a rescue. The cat began to purr. Hello, Volts number two. You seem happy here. Are we all as happy as you? The cat purred a possible affirmation and rubbed his head against Nora's leg. She picked him up and went over to the bar. There was a row of craft beers on the pumps, stouts and ciders and pale ales and IPAs. Vicar's Favourite, Lost and Found, Miss Marple, Sleeping Lemons, Broken Dream. There was a charity tin on the bar for butterfly conservation. She heard the sound of clinking glass, as if a dishwasher was being filled. Nora felt anxiety constrict her chest, a familiar sensation. Then a spindly 20-something man in a baggy rugby top popped up from behind the bar, hardly giving any attention to Nora as he gathered the last remaining used glasses and put them in the dishwasher. He switched it on, then pulled down his coat from a hook, put it on, and took out some car keys. Bye, Nora. I've done the chairs and wiped all the tables. Dishwasher's on. Oh, thanks. Till Thursday. Yes, Nora said, feeling like a spy about to have her cover blown. See you. A moment after the man left, she heard footsteps rising up from somewhere below, heading across the tiles she had just walked down, coming from the back of the pub. And then he was there. He looked different. The beard had gone, and there were more wrinkles around his eyes, dark circles. He had a nearly finished pint of dark beer in his hand. He still looked a bit like a TV vet, just a few more series down the line. Dan, she said, as if he was something that needed identifying, like a rabbit by the road. I just want to say, I am so proud of you. So proud of us. He looked at her blankly. Was just turning the chiller units off. Got to clean the lines tomorrow, we've left it a fortnight. Nora had no idea what he was talking about. She stroked the cat. Right, yes, of course, the lines. Her husband, for in this life that was who he was, looked around at all the tables and upside-down chairs. He was wearing a faded Jaws t-shirt. Have Blake and Sophie gone home? Nora hesitated. She sensed he was talking about people who worked for them. The young man in the baggy rugby top was presumably Blake. There didn't seem to be anyone else around. Yes, she said, trying to sound natural despite the fundamental bizarreness of the circumstances. I think they have. They were pretty on top of things. Cool. She remembered buying him the Jaws t-shirt on his 26th birthday, 10 years previously. The answers tonight were something else. One of the teams, the one Pete and Jolie were on, thought Maradona painted the Sistine ceiling. Nora nodded and stroked vaults number two, as if she had any idea who on earth Pete and Jolie were. To be fair, it was a tricky one tonight. Might take them from another website next time. I mean, who actually knows the name of the highest mountain in the Karawatsit range? Karakoram, Nora asked. That would be K2. Well, obviously you know, he said a little too abruptly, a little too tipsily. That was the kind of thing you would know, because while most people were into rock music, you were into actual rocks and stuff. Hey, she said, I was literally in a band. A band, she remembered then, that Dan had hated her being in. He laughed. She recognized the laugh, but didn't entirely like it. She'd forgotten how often during their relationship Dan's humor hinged on other people, specifically Nora. When they'd been together, she'd tried not to dwell on this aspect of his personality. He'd had so many other aspects. He'd been so lovely to her mum when she was ill, and he could talk at ease about anything. He was so full of dreams about the future. He was attractive and easy to be around, and he was passionate about art and always stopped to chat of the homeless. He cared about the world. A person was like a city. You couldn't let a few less desirable parts put you off the whole. There may be bits you don't like, a few dodgy side streets and suburbs, but the good stuff makes it worthwhile. He had listened to a lot of annoying podcasts that he thought Nora should listen to, and laughed in a way that grated on her, and gargled loudly with mouthwash. And yes, he hogged the duvet, and could occasionally be arrogant in his opinions on art and film and music, but there was nothing overtly wrong with him. Well, now that she thought about it, he'd never been supportive of her music career, and had advised her that being in the labyrinths and signing a music deal would be bad for her mental health, and that her brother was being a bit selfish. But at the time she had viewed that not so much as a red flag, but a green one. Her thinking was, he cared. And it was nice to have someone who cared, who wasn't bothered about fame and superficialities, and could help navigate the waters of life. And so when he had asked her to marry him, in the cocktail bar on the top floor of the Oxo Tower, she had agreed. And maybe she had always been right to agree. He stepped forward into the room, placing his pint down momentarily, and was now on his phone looking up better pub quiz questions. She wondered how much he had drunk tonight. She wondered if the dream of owning a pub had really been the dream of drinking an endless supply of alcohol. What is the name of a 20-sided polygon? I don't know. Nora lied, not wanting to risk a similar reaction to the one she'd received a moment ago. He put the phone in his pocket. We did well, though. They all drank loads tonight. Not bad for a Tuesday. Things are looking up. I mean, there's something to tell the bank tomorrow. Maybe they'll give us an extension on the loan. He stared at the beer in his glass, swilled it around a little, and then downed it. Though I've got to tell AJ to change the lunch menu. No one in Littleworth wants to eat candied beetroot and broad bean salad and corn cakes. This isn't pissing Fitzrovia. And I know they're going down well, but I think those wines you chose aren't worth it. Especially the Californian ones. Okay. He turned and looked behind him. Where's the board? What? The chalkboard. Thought you'd brought it in. So that was what she had been outside for. No, I'm going to do it now. Thought I saw you go out. Nora smiled away her nerves. Yes, well, I did. I had to, I was worried about our cat, Bolts Voltaire. I couldn't find him, so I went outside to look for him, and then I found him, didn't I? Dan was back behind the bar, pouring himself a scotch. He seemed to sense she was judging him. This is only my third, fourth, maybe. It's quiz night. You know I get nervous doing the comparing. And it helps me be funny. And I was funny, don't you reckon? Yes, very funny. Total funniness. His face fell into a serious mode. I saw you talking to Erin. What did she say? Nora wasn't sure how best to answer this. Oh, nothing much. The usual stuff, you know, Erin. The usual stuff? I didn't think you'd ever spoken to her before. I meant the usual stuff that people say, not what Erin says, usual people stuff. How's Will doing? Really well, Nora guessed. He says hi. Dan's eyes popped wide with surprise. Really? Nora had no idea what to say. Maybe Will was a baby. Maybe Will was in a coma. Sorry, no, he didn't say hi. Sorry, I'm not thinking. Anyway, I'll go and get the board. She put the cat down on the floor and headed back out. This time she noticed something she had missed on entering. A framed newspaper article from the Oxford Times with a picture of Nora and Dan standing outside the Three Horseshoes. Dan had his arm around her. He was wearing a suit she had never seen before, and she was in a smart dress she would never have worn. She rarely wore dresses in her original life. Pub owners make dream a reality. They had, according to the article, bought the pub cheaply and in a neglected state, and then renovated it with a mix of modest inheritance, Dan's, and savings and bank loans. The article presented a success story, though it was 2 years old. She stepped outside, wondering whether her life could really be judged from just a few minutes after midnight on a Tuesday. Or maybe that was all you needed. The wind was picking up. Standing out on that quiet village street, the gusts pushed the board a little along the path, nearly toppling it over. Before she picked it up, she felt a buzz from a phone in her pocket. She hadn't realized it was in there. She pulled it out, a text message from Izzy. She noticed that her wallpaper was a photo of herself and Dan somewhere hot. She unlocked the phone using facial recognition and opened the message. It was a photo of a whale rising high out of the ocean, the white spray soaking the air like a burst of champagne. It was a wonderful photo, and just seeing it caused her to smile. Izzy was typing. Another message appeared. This was one of the pics I took yesterday from the boat. And another. Humpback mother. Then another photo. Two whales this time, their backs breaking the water. With calf. The last message also included emojis of whales and waves. Nora felt a warm glow. Not just from the pictures, which were indisputably lovely, but from the contact with Izzy. When Nora backed out of her wedding to Dan, Izzy had insisted that she come to Australia with her. They'd mapped it all out, a plan to live near Byron Bay and get jobs on one of the whale-watching boat cruises. They had shared lots of clips of humpback whales in anticipation of this new adventure. But then Nora had wobbled and backed out, just like she had backed out of a swimming career and a band and a wedding. But unlike those other things, there hadn't even been a reason. Yes, she had started working at String Theory, and yes, she felt the need to tend to her parents' graves, but she knew that staying in Bedford was the worse option. And yet she picked it, because of some strange, predictive homesickness that festered alongside a depression that told her, ultimately, she didn't deserve to be happy. That she had hurt Dan, and that a life of drizzle and depression in her hometown was her punishment. And she hadn't the will, or clarity, or, hell, the energy to do anything. So, in effect, she swapped her best friend for a cat. In her actual life, she had never fallen out with Izzy. Nothing that dramatic. But after Izzy had gone to Australia, things had faded between them. Until their friendship became just a vapor trail of sporadic Facebook and Instagram likes in emoji-filled birthday messages. She looked back through the text conversations between her and Izzy and realized that even though there were still 10,000 miles between them, They had a much better relationship in this version of things. When she returned to the pub, carrying the sign this time, Dan was nowhere to be seen. So she locked the back door and waited a while, in the pub hallway, working out where the stairs were, and unsure if she actually wanted to follow her tipsy sort of husband up there. She found the stairs at the rear of the building, through a door that said, "Staff Only." As she stepped on the beige raffia carpet heading towards the stairs, just after a framed poster of Things You Learn in the Dark, one of her favourite Ryan Bailey movies which they had watched together at the Odeon in Bedford, she noted a smaller picture on a sweet little windowsill. It was their wedding photo. Black and white, reportage style, walking out of the church into a shower of confetti. It was difficult to see their faces properly, but they were both laughing, and it was a shared laugh, and they seemed, as far as a photograph can tell you anything, to be in love. She'd remembered her mum talking about Dan. "He's a good one. You're so lucky. Keep hold of him." She saw her brother, Joe, too, shaven-headed and looking genuinely happy. Champagne glass in hand and his short-lived, disastrous investment banker boyfriend, Lewis, by his side. Izzy was there, and Ravi, too, looking more like an accountant than a drummer, standing next to a bespectacled woman she'd never seen before. While Dan was in the toilet, Nora located the bedroom. Although they evidently had money worries, the nervous appointment with the bank confirmed that, the room was expensively furnished. Smart window blinds, a wide, comfortable-looking bed, the duvet crisp and clean and white. There were books either side of the bed. In her actual life, she hadn't had a book by her bed for at least 6 months. She hadn't read anything for 6 months. Maybe in this life she had a better concentration span. She picked up one of the books, Meditation for Beginners. Underneath it was a copy of a biography of her favourite philosopher, Henry David Thoreau. There were books on Dan's bedside table too. The last book she remembered him reading had been a biography of Toulouse-Lautrec, Tiny Giant. But in this life he was reading a business book called Zero to Hero, Harnessing Success in Work, Play and Life, and the latest edition of The Good Pub Guide. She felt different in her body, a little healthier, a little stronger, but tense. She patted her stomach and realized that in this life she worked out a bit more. Her hair felt different too. She had a heavy fringe and, feeling it, she could tell her hair was longer at the back. Her mind felt a little woozy. She must have had at least a couple of glasses of wine. A moment later she heard the toilet flush. Then she heard gargling. It seemed a bit noisier than necessary. "Are you all right?" Dan asked when he came into the bedroom. His voice, she realized, didn't sound like she remembered. It sounded emptier. A bit colder. Maybe it was tiredness. Maybe it was stress. Maybe it was beer. Maybe it was marriage. Maybe it was something else. It was hard to remember exactly what he had sounded like before. What he had been like, precisely. But that was the nature of memory. At university, she had done an essay dryly titled The Principles of Hobbesian Memory and Imagination. Thomas Hobbes had viewed memory and imagination as pretty much the same thing, and since discovering that, she had never entirely trusted her memories. Outside the window, the street lamp's yellow glow illuminated the desolate village road. "Nora, you're acting strange. Why are you just standing in the middle of the room? Are you getting ready for bed, or are you doing some kind of standing meditation?" He laughed. He thought he was funny. He went over to the window and pulled the curtains. Then he took off his jeans and put them on the back of a chair. She stared at him and tried to feel the attraction she had once felt so deeply. It seemed to require a Herculean effort. She hadn't expected this. Everyone's lives could have ended up an infinite number of ways. He collapsed heavily on the bed, a whale into the ocean, picked up Zero to Hero, tried to focus, put it down, picked up a laptop by the bed, shoved an earphone into his ear. Maybe he was going to listen to a podcast. I'm just thinking about something. She began to feel faint, as if she was only half there. She remembered Mrs. Elm talking about how disappointment in her life would bring her back to the library. It would feel, she realized, altogether too strange to climb into the same bed with a man she hadn't seen for 2 years. She noticed the time on the digital alarm clock. 12:23. Still, with the earphone in his ear, he looked at her again. Right, listen, if you don't want to make babies tonight, you can just say, you know. What? I mean, I know we'll have to wait another month until you're ovulating again. We're trying for a baby. I want a baby. Nora, what's with you? Why are you strange today? She took off her shoes. I'm not. A memory came to her, related to the Jaws t-shirt. A tune, actually. Beautiful Sky. The day she had bought Dan the Jaws t-shirt had been the day she had played him a song she'd written for the Labyrinths. Beautiful Sky. It was, she was convinced, the best song she had ever written. And more than that, it was a happy song to reflect her optimism at that point in her life. It was a song inspired by her new life with Dan. And he had listened to it with the shruggish indifference that had hurt at the time, and which she would have addressed if it hadn't been his birthday. Yeah, he'd said. It's okay. She wondered why that memory had stayed buried, only to rise up now, like the great white shark on his fading t-shirt. There were other things coming back to her now, too. His over-the-top reaction when she'd once told him about a customer. Ash, the surgeon and amateur guitar player who came into string theory for the occasional songbook, casually asking Nora if she wanted to go for a coffee sometime. Of course I said no. Stop shouting. Worse, though, was when an A&R man for a major label, or rather a boutique former indie label with Universal behind them, wanted to sign the Labyrinths. Dan had told her that it was unlikely they'd survive as a couple. He'd also heard a horror story from one of his university friends who'd been in a band that signed to a label, and then the label ripped them off and they'd all become unemployed alcoholics or something. I could take you with me, she said. I'd get it in the contract. We could go everywhere together. Sorry, Nora, but that's your dream. It's not mine. Which hurt even more with hindsight, knowing how much, before the wedding, she tried to make his dream of a pub in the Oxfordshire countryside become her dream as well. Dan had always said his concern was for Nora. She'd been having panic attacks while she was in the band, especially when she got anywhere near a stage. But the concern had been at least a little manipulative now she thought about it. I thought, he was saying now, that you were starting to trust me again. Trust you? Dan, why wouldn't I trust you? You know why. Of course I know why, she lied. I just want to hear you say it. Well, since the stuff with Erin. She stared at him like he was a Rorschach inkblot in which she saw no clear image. Erin, the one I was speaking to tonight. Am I going to be beaten up forever about one stupid drunken moment? On the street outside, the wind was picking up, howling through trees as if attempting a language. This was the life she had been in mourning for. This was the life she had beaten herself up for not living. This was the timeline she thought she had regretted not existing in. One stupid mistake, she echoed. Okay, two. It was multiplying. Two? I was in a state, you know, the pressure of this place, and I was very drunk. You had sex with someone else, and it doesn't seem you have been seeking much atonement. Seriously, why drag all this up? We've been through this. Remember what the counsellor said about focusing on where we want to go rather than where we've been? Do you ever think that maybe we just aren't right for each other? What? I love you, Dan. And you can be a very kind person. And you were great with my mum. And we used to... I mean, we have great conversations. But do you ever feel that we passed where we were meant to be? That we changed? She sat down on the edge of the bed, the furthest corner away from him. Do you ever feel lucky to have me? Do you realize how close I was to leaving you 2 days before the wedding? Do you know how messed up you would have been if I hadn't turned up at the wedding? Wow. Really? You have yourself in quite high esteem there, Nora. Shouldn't I? I mean, shouldn't everyone? What's wrong with self-esteem? And besides, it's true. There's another universe where you send me WhatsApp messages about how messed up you are without me. How you turn to alcohol, although it seems like you turn to alcohol with me too. You send me texts saying you miss my voice. He made a dismissive noise somewhere between a laugh and a grunt. Well, right now I am most definitely not missing your voice. She couldn't get beyond her shoes. She found it hard, maybe impossible, to take off another item of clothing in front of him. And stop going on about my drinking. If you are using drink as an excuse for screwing someone else, I can go on about your drinking. I am a country landlord, scoffed Dan. It's what country landlords do. Be jovial and merry and willing to partake in the many and manifold beverages we sell. Jeez. Since when did he speak like this? Did he always speak like this? Bloody hell, Dan. He didn't even seem bothered. To seem grateful in any way for the universe he was in. The universe she had felt so guilty for not allowing to happen. He reached for his phone, still with a laptop on the duvet. Nora watched him as he scrolled. Is this what you imagined? Is this the dream working out? Nora, let's not do this heavy shit. Just get to bloody bed. Are you happy, Dan? No one's happy, Nora. Some people are. You used to be. You used to light up when you talked about this. You know, the pub. Before you had it, this is the life you dreamed of. You wanted me and you wanted this. And yet you've been unfaithful and you drink like a fish and I think you only appreciate me when you don't have me, which is not a great trait to have. What about my dreams? He was hardly listening or trying to look like he wasn't. Big fires in California, he said, almost to himself. Well, at least we're not there. He put the phone down, folded his laptop. You coming to bed or what? She had shrunk for him. But he still hadn't found the space he needed. No more. Ikosagon, she told him. What? The quiz, earlier. The 20-sided polygon. Well, a 20-sided polygon is called an ikosagon. I knew the answer, but didn't tell you because I didn't want you to mock me. And now I don't really care, because I don't think me knowing some things that you don't should bother you. And also, I am going to the bathroom. And she left Dan. With his mouth open, and trod gently on the wide floorboards out of the room. She reached the bathroom, switched a light on. There were tingles in her arms and legs and torso, like electric static in search of a station. She was fading out. She was sure. There wasn't long left here. The disappointment was complete. It was an impressive bathroom. There was a mirror. She gasped at her reflection. She looked healthier, but also older. Her hair made her look like a stranger. This was not the life she imagined it to be. And Nora wished herself in the mirror, good luck. And the moment after that she was back, somewhere inside the midnight library, and Mrs. Elm was staring at her from a small distance away with a curious smile. Well, how did that go? The penultimate update Nora had posted before she found herself between life and death. Do you ever think, how did I end up here? Like you're in a maze and totally lost, and it's all your fault because you were the one who made every turn. And you know that there are many routes that could have helped you out, because you hear all the people on the outside of the maze who made it through, and they're laughing and smiling. And sometimes you get a glimpse of them through the hedge, a fleeting shape through the leaves. And they seem so damn happy to have made it. And you don't resent them. But you do resent yourself for not having their ability to work it all out. Do you? Or is this maze just for me? P.S. My cat died. The chessboard. The shelves of the midnight library were quite still again, as if their movement had never even been a possibility. Nora sensed that they were in a different portion of the library now, not a different room as such, as there seemed to be only one infinitely vast room. It was difficult to tell if she really was in a different part of the library, as the books were still green, though she seemed closer to a corridor than where she had been. And from here she could see a glimpse of something new through one of the stacks, an office desk and computer, like a basic makeshift open-plan office positioned in the corridor between the aisles. Mrs. Elm wasn't at the office desk. She was sat at a low wooden table right there in front of Nora, and she was playing chess. It was different to how I imagined, said Nora. Mrs. Elm looked like she was halfway through a game. It's hard to predict, isn't it? She asked, looking blankly in front of her as she moved a black bishop across the board to take a white pawn. The things that will make us happy. Mrs. Elm rotated the chessboard through 180 degrees. She was, it appeared, playing against herself. Yes, said Nora. It is. But what happens to her, to me? How does she end up? How do I know? I only know today. I know a lot about today, but I don't know what happens tomorrow. But she'll be there in the bathroom and you won't know how she got there. And have you ever walked into a room and forgotten what you came in for? Have you never forgotten what you just did? Have you never blanked out or misremembered what you were just doing? Yes, but I was there for half an hour in that life. And that other you won't know that. She will remember what you just did and said, but as if she did and said them. Nora let out a deep exhale. Dan wasn't like that. People change, said Mrs. Elm, still looking at the chessboard. Her hand lingered over a bishop. Nora rethought. Oh, maybe he was like that, and I just didn't see it. So, wondered Mrs. Elm, looking at Nora, what are you feeling? Like I still want to die? I have wanted to die for quite a while. I have carefully calculated that the pain of me living as the bloody disaster that is my life is greater than the pain anyone else will feel if I were to die. In fact, I'm sure it would be a relief. I'm not useful to anyone. I was bad at work. I've disappointed everyone. I'm a waste of a carbon footprint, to be honest. I hurt people. I have no one left. Not even poor old Volts, who died because I couldn't look after a cat properly. I want to die. My life is a disaster, and I want it to end. I am not cut out for living, and there is no point going through all this, because I'm clearly destined to be unhappy in other lives too. That is just me. I add nothing. I am wallowing in self-pity. I want to die. Mrs. Elm studied Nora hard, as if reading a passage in a book she had read before but had just found it contained new meaning. Want, she told her in a measured tone, is an interesting word. It means lack. Sometimes if we fill that lack with something else, the original want disappears entirely. Maybe you have a lack problem rather than a want problem. Maybe there is a life that you really want to live. I thought that was it. The one with Dan, but it wasn't. No, it wasn't. But that is just one of your possible lives. And one into infinity is a very small fraction indeed. Every possible life I could live has me in it. So it's not really every possible life. Mrs. Elm wasn't listening. Now, tell me, where do you want to go now? Nowhere, please. Do you need another look at the Book of Regrets? Nora scrunched her nose and gave a minute shake of her head. She remembered the feeling of being suffocated by so much regret. No. What about your cat? What was his name again? Voltaire. It was a bit pretentious, and he wasn't really a pretentious cat, so I just called him Volts for short. Sometimes Voltsy, if I was feeling jovial, which was rare, obviously. I couldn't even finalize a name for a cat. Well, you said you were bad at having a cat. What would you have done differently? Nora thought. She had the very real sense that Mrs. Elm was playing some kind of game with her. But she also wanted to see her cat again, and not simply a cat with the same name. In fact, she wanted it more than anything. Okay, I'd like to see the life where I kept Voltaire indoors. My Voltaire. I'd like the life where I didn't try and kill myself, and where I was a good cat owner, and I didn't let him out onto the road last night. I'd like that life, just for a little while. That life exists, doesn't it? The only way to learn is to live. Nora looked round and found herself lying in her own bed. She checked her watch. It was 1 minute past midnight. She switched on her light. This was her exact life. But it was going to be better, because Voltaire was going to be alive in this one. Her real Voltaire. But where was he? Bolts? She climbed out of bed. Bolts? She looked all over her flat and couldn't find him anywhere. The rain pattered against the windows. That much hadn't changed. Her new box of antidepressants was out on the kitchen unit. The electric piano stood by the wall, silent. Boltsy? There was her yucca plant and her three tiny potted cacti. There were her bookshelves, with exactly the same mix of philosophy books and novels, and untried yoga manuals and rock star biographies and pop science books. An old National Geographic with a shark on the cover, and a five-month-old copy of Elle magazine, which she'd bought mainly for the Ryan Bailey interview. No new additions in a long time. There was a bowl still full of cat food. She looked everywhere, calling his name. It was only when she went back into her bedroom and looked under the bed that she saw him. Pulse! The cat wasn't moving. As her arms weren't long enough to reach him, she moved the bed. Voltsy! Come on! Voltsy! She whispered. But the moment she touched his cold body, she knew, and she was flooded with sadness and confusion. She immediately found herself back in the midnight library, facing Mrs. Elm, who was sat this time in a comfy chair, deeply absorbed in one of the books. I don't understand, Nora told her. Mrs. Elm kept her eyes on the page she was reading. There will be many things you don't understand. I asked for the life in which Voltaire was still alive. Actually, you didn't. What? She put her book down. You asked for the life where you kept him indoors. That is an entirely different thing. Is it? Yes, entirely. You see, if you had asked for the life where he was still alive, I would have had to say no. But why? Because it doesn't exist. I thought every life exists. Every possible life. You see, it turns out that Voltaire had a serious case of, she read carefully from the book, restrictive cardiomyopathy, a severe case of it, which he was born with, and which was destined to cause his heart to go at a young age. But he was hit by a car. There is a difference, Nora, between dying in a road and being hit by a car. In your root life, Voltaire lived longer than almost any other life, except the one you just encountered, where he died only 3 hours ago. Although he had a tough few early years, the year you had him was the best of his life. Voltaire has had much worse lives, believe me. You didn't even know his name a moment ago. Now you know he had restrictive cardio whatever. I knew his name, and it wasn't a moment ago. It was the same moment. Check your watch. Why did you lie? I wasn't lying. I asked you what your cat's name was. I never said I didn't know what your cat's name was. Do you understand the difference? I just wanted you to say his name so that you would feel something. Nora was hot with agitation now. That's even worse. You sent me into that life knowing Volz would be dead. And Volz was dead, so nothing changed. Mrs. Elm's eyes twinkled again. Except you. What do you mean? Well, you don't see yourself as a bad cat owner anymore. You looked after him as well as he could have been looked after. He loved you as much as you loved him. And maybe he didn't want you to see him die. You see, cats know. They understand when their time is up. He went outside because he was going to die. And he knew it. Nora tried to take this in. Now she thought about it, there hadn't been any external signs of damage on her cat's body. She had just jumped to the same conclusion that Ash had jumped to, that a dead cat on the road was probably dead because of the road. And if a surgeon could think that, a mere layperson would think that too. 2 + 2 = car accident. Poor Volz, Nora muttered mournfully. Mrs. Elm smiled, like a teacher who saw a lesson being understood. He loved you, Nora. You looked after him as well as anyone could. Go and look at the last page of the Book of Regrets. Nora could see that the book was lying on the floor. She knelt on the floor beside it. I don't want to open it again. Don't worry. It will be safer this time. Just stick to the last page. Once she had flicked to the last page, she saw one of her very last regrets. I was bad at looking after Voltaire. Slowly disappear from the page. The letters fading like retreating strangers in a fog. Nora closed the book before she could feel anything bad happen. So you see, sometimes regrets aren't based on fact at all. Sometimes regrets are just... She searched for the appropriate term and found it. A load of bullshit. Nora tried to think back to her school days to remember if Mrs. Elm had ever said the word bullshit before, and she was pretty sure she hadn't. But I still don't get why you would let me go into that life if you knew Volz was going to be dead anyway. You could have told me. You could have just told me I wasn't a bad cat owner. Why didn't you? Because, Nora... Sometimes the only way to learn is to live. Sounds hard. Take a seat, Mrs. Elm told her. A proper seat. It's not right to you kneeling on the floor. And Nora turned to see a chair behind her that she hadn't noticed before. An antique chair, mahogany and buttoned leather, Edwardian maybe, with a brass bookstand attached to one arm. Give yourself a moment. Nora sat down. She stared at her watch. No matter how much of a moment she gave herself, it stayed being midnight. I still don't like this. One life of sadness was enough. What is the point of risking more? Fine. Mrs. Elm shrugged. What? Let's do nothing then. You can just stay here in the library with all those lives waiting on the shelf and not choose one. Nora sensed Mrs. Elm was playing some kind of game, but she went along with it. Fine. So Nora just stood there while Mrs. Elm picked up her book again. It seemed unfair to Nora that Mrs. Elm could read the lives without falling into them. Time went by, although technically, of course, it didn't. Nora could have stayed there forever without getting hungry or thirsty or tired, but she could, it seemed, get bored. As time stood still, Nora's curiosity about the lives around her slowly grew. It turned out to be near impossible to stand in a library and not want to pull things from the shelves.
"Why can't you just give me a life you know is a good one?" she said suddenly.
"That is not how the library works." Nora had another question.
"Surely in most lives I'll be asleep now, won't I?"
"In many, yes."
"So what happens then?"
"You sleep, and then you wake up in that life.
It's nothing to worry about.
But if you are nervous, you could try a life where it's another time."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, it's not night time everywhere, is it?"
"What?"
"There are an infinite number of possible universes in which you live. Are you really saying they all exist on Greenwich Mean Time?"
"Of course not," said Nora.
She realized she was about to cave in and choose another life. She thought of the humpback whales. She thought of the unanswered message. "I wish I had gone to Australia with Izzy. I would like to experience that life."
"Very good choice."
"What? Is it a very good life?"
"Oh, I didn't say that. I merely feel that you might be getting better at choosing."
"So it's a bad life."
"I didn't say that either."
And the shelves sped into motion again, then stopped a few seconds afterwards.
"Ah, yes. There it is,"
said Mrs. Elm, taking a book from the second to bottom shelf. She recognized it instantly, which was odd, seeing that it looked almost identical to the others around it. She handed it to Nora affectionately, as if it was a birthday gift.
"There you go. You know what to do."
Nora hesitated.
"What if I'm dead?"
"Sorry?"
"I mean in another life. There must be other lives in which I died before today."
Mrs. Elm looked intrigued.
"Isn't that what you wanted?"
"Well, yes, but you have died an infinite number of times before today, yes. Car accident, drug overdose, drowning, a bout of fatal food poisoning, choking on an apple, choking on a cookie, choking on a vegan hot dog, choking on a non-vegan hot dog. Every illness it was possible for you to catch or contract. You have died in every way you can, at any time you could.
So I could open a book and just die?"
"No, not instantaneously. As with Voltaire, the only lives available here are, well, lives. I mean, you could die in that life, but you won't have died before you enter the life, because this midnight library is not one of ghosts. It is not a library of corpses. It is a library of possibility. And death is the opposite of possibility. Understand?"
"I think so."
And Nora stared at the book she had been handed. Conifer green, smooth textured, again embossed with that broad and frustratingly meaningless title, My Life. She opened it and saw a blank page. So she moved to the next page and wondered what was going to happen this time. The swimming pool was a little busier than normal. And then she was there. Fire. She gasped. The sensations were sudden, the noise and the water. She had her mouth open and she choked, the tang and sting of salt water. She tried to touch her feet on the bottom of the pool, but she was out of her depth, so she quickly slipped into breaststroke mode. A swimming pool, but a salt water one, outdoor beside the ocean. Carved seemingly out of the rock that jutted out of the coastline. She could see the actual ocean just beyond. There was sunshine overhead. The water was cool, but given the heat of the air above her, the cool was welcome. Once upon a time, she had been the best 14-year-old female swimmer in Bedfordshire. She'd won 2 races in her age category at the National Junior Swimming Championships. Freestyle 400 metres, freestyle 200 metres. Her dad had driven her every day to the local pool. Sometimes before school as well as after. But then, while her brother rocked out on his guitar to Nirvana, she traded lengths for scales and taught herself how to play not just Chopin, but classics like Let It Be and Rainy Days and Mondays. She also began, before the labyrinths were even a figment of her brother's imagination, to compose her own music. But she hadn't really gone off swimming, just the pressure around it. She reached the side of the pool, stopped and looked around. She could see a beach at a lower level in the distance, curving around in a semicircle to welcome the sea lapping on its sand. Beyond the beach, inland, a stretch of grass. A park complete with palm trees and distant dog walkers. Beyond that, houses and low-rise apartment blocks, and traffic sliding by on a road. She'd seen pictures of Byron Bay, and it didn't look quite like this. This place, wherever it was, seemed a little more built up. Still surferish, but also urban. Turning her attention back to the pool, she noticed a man smile at her as he adjusted his goggles. Did she know this man? Would she welcome this smile in this life? Having no idea, she offered the smallest of polite smiles in return. She felt like a tourist with an unfamiliar currency, not knowing how much to tip. Then an elderly woman in a swimming cap smiled at her as she glided through the water towards her. "Morning, Nora," she said, not breaking her stroke. It was a greeting that suggested Nora was a regular here. "Morning," Nora said. She stared out at the ocean to avoid any awkward chatting. A flock of morning surfers, speck-sized, swam on their boards to greet large sapphire blue waves. This was a promising start to her Australian life. She stared at her watch. It was a bright orange, cheap-looking Casio. A happy-looking watch, suggestive, she hoped, of a happy-feeling life. It was just after 9 a.m. here. Next to her watch was a plastic wristband with a key on it. So this was her morning ritual here, in an outdoor swimming pool beside a beach. She wondered if she was here alone. She scanned the pool hopefully for any sign of Izzy, but none was there. She swam some more. The thing she had once loved about swimming was the disappearing. In the water, her focus had been so pure that she thought of nothing else. Any school or home worries vanished. The art of swimming, she supposed like any art, was about purity. The more focused you were on the activity, the less focused you were on everything else. You kind of stopped being you and became the thing you were doing. But it was hard to stay focused when Nora noticed her arms and chest ached. She sensed it had been a long swim and was probably time to get out of the pool. She saw a sign, Bronte Beach Swimming Pool. She vaguely remembered Dan, who'd been to Australia in his gap year, talking about this place, and the name had stuck, Bronte Beach, because it was easy to remember. Jane Eyre on a surfboard. But here was confirmation of her doubt. Bronte Beach was in Sydney, but it most definitely wasn't part of Byron Bay. So that meant one of two things. Either Izzy, in this life, wasn't in Byron Bay, or Nora wasn't with Izzy. She noticed she was tanned a mild caramel all over. Of course, the trouble was, she didn't know where her clothes were. But then she remembered the plastic wristband with a key on it. 57. Her locker was 57. So she found the changing rooms and opened the squat, square locker and saw that her taste in clothes, as well as watches, was more colourful in this life. She had a t-shirt with a pineapple print on it, a whole cornucopia of pineapples, and pink-purple denim shorts, and slip-on checked pumps. What am I? She wondered. A children's TV presenter? Sunblock. Hibiscus-tinted lip balm. No other makeup as such. As she pulled on her T-shirt, she noticed a couple of marks on her arm. Scar lines. She wondered, momentarily, if they had been self-inflicted. There was also a tattoo just below her shoulder. A phoenix in flames. It was a terrible tattoo. In this life, she clearly had no taste. But since when did taste have anything to do with happiness? She dressed and pulled out a phone from her shorts pocket. This was an older model than in her married and living in a pub life. Luckily, a thumb reading was enough to unlock it. She left the changing rooms and walked along a beachside path. It was a warm day. Maybe life was automatically better when the sun shone so confidently in April. Everything seemed more vivid, more colourful and alive than it had done in England. She saw a parrot, a sky blue and banana yellow macaw, perched on the top of a bench, being photographed by a couple of tourists. A surfy-looking cyclist passed by holding an orange smoothie, smiling and literally saying, "G'day." This was most definitely not Bedford. Nora noticed something was happening to her face. She was, could she be? Smiling. And naturally, not just because someone expected her to. Then she noticed a piece of graffiti on a low wall which said, "The world is on fire." And another that said, "One earth equals one chance." And her smile faded. After all, a different life didn't mean a different planet. She had no idea where she lived or what she did or where she was meant to be heading after the swimming pool. But there was something quite freeing about that. To be existing without any expectation, even her own. As she walked, she Googled her own name and added Sydney to see if it brought up anything. Before she scanned the results, she glanced up and noticed a man walking on the path towards her, smiling. A short, tanned man with kind eyes and long, thinning hair in a loose ponytail, with a shirt that wasn't buttoned correctly. "Hey, Nora." "Hey," she said, trying not to sound confused. "What time do you start today?" How could she answer that? Crap, I've totally forgotten." He laughed. A little laugh of recognition, as if her forgetting was quite in character. "I saw it on the rota. I think it might be 11. 11 a.m.? Kind Eyes laughed. "What have you been smoking? I want some." "Huh. Nothing," she said stiffly. "I've not been smoking anything. I just skipped breakfast." "Well, see you this arvo." "Yes, at the, place. Where is it again?" He laughed frowningly and kept walking. Maybe she worked on a whale sightseeing cruise that operated out of Sydney. Maybe Izzy did too. Nora had no idea where she or they lived, and nothing was coming up on Google. But away from the ocean seemed the right direction. Maybe she was very local. Maybe she had walked here. Maybe one of the bikes she saw locked up outside the pool cafe had been hers. She rummaged in her tiny clasp wallet and felt her pockets for a key, but there was only a house key. No car keys, no bike keys. So it was a bus, all by foot. The house key had no information on it at all, so she sat on a bench with the sun beating hard on the back of her neck and checked her texts. There were names of people she didn't recognize. Amy. Rodri, Bella, Lucy P, Kamala, Luke, Lucy M. Who are these people? And a rather unhelpful contact titled simply Work. And there was only one recent message from Work, and it said, "Where are you?" There was one name she recognized. Dan. Her heart sank as she clicked on his most recent message. "Hey, Nor,"
Hope Oz is treating you well. This is going to sound either corny or creepy, but I'm going to go all out and tell you. I had a dream the other night about our pub. It was such a good dream. We were so happy. Anyway, ignore that weirdness. The point of this is to say, guess where I'm going in May? Australia. First time in over a decade. I'm coming with work. I'm working with MCA. Would be great to catch up even for a coffee if you're around. D. Kiss. It was so strange she almost laughed. But she coughed instead. Maybe she wasn't quite so fit in this life now she thought about it. She wondered how many Dans there were in the world, dreaming of things they would hate if they actually got them. And how many were pushing other people into their delusional idea of happiness. Instagram seemed to be the only social media she had here, and she only seemed to post pictures of poems on it. She took a moment to read one. Fire. Every part of her that changed, that got scraped off because of schoolyard laughter or the advice of grown-ups, long gone, and the pain of friends already dead.